Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Afghanistan's economy is imploding, with all but 3% of households expected to fall below the poverty line in coming months, the UN said on Thursday. To help ordinary Afghans, the UN Development Programme has announced the launch of a People's Economy Fund to provide desperately needed access to cash. The fund will tap into donations frozen since the Taliban takeover in August. Germany has already pledged $58 million of the more than $660 million required over the next 12 months, said Achim Steiner, UNDP Administrator.
There are 38 million people who cannot be kept alive just from the outside. We have to step in, we have to stabilize a people's economy, and in addition to saving lives in the immediate, we also have to save livelihoods, because otherwise we will confront indeed a scenario through this winter and into next year where millions and millions of Afghans are simply unable to stay on their land, in their homes, in their villages, and survive.
New data analysed by the WHO has revealed that between 80,000 and 180,000 healthcare workers could have died from COVID-19 between January last year and May 2021. These estimates were calculated from the 3.45 million coronavirus-related deaths reported globally to the UN Health Agency as of May this year, a figure that WHO said may well be at least 60% lower than the actual number of victims. The development comes as the UN Health Agency warned that the pandemic will go on a year longer than it needs to because poorer countries have not received the vaccines they should have. Barely 1 in 20 people in Africa have been vaccinated, compared with around 4 in 10 globally. In a call for concrete action to better protect health and care workers worldwide from COVID-19 and other infections, WHO and partner organizations expressed concern at the large number of health and care workers who have died from the virus, but also that an increasing proportion is suffering from burnout, stress, anxiety, and fatigue. The UN has announced sweeping initiatives to strengthen the gathering of data which is needed for accurate weather and climate forecasting to protect vulnerable communities around the globe. Announcing the news on Thursday, the World Meteorological Organization said that all 193 member states had approved the sharing of vital observations in the face of climate change and increasing extreme weather events. The agency has unveiled three new protocols to boost information sharing, which will help to fill data gaps in some regions, and at the same time try to meet huge demand for weather and climate data products and services. Welcoming the development, WMO's Secretary General Petteri Tallas said that the growing vulnerability of people living in high-risk areas and concerns about issues such as food security are contributing to a huge increase in demand for information about weather, climate and water and their impacts. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. More than 1 million people in southern Madagascar are going hungry in what the World Food Programme, WFP, believes could become the first ever famine brought on by climate change. Successive years of drought have forced people in rural communities to eat locusts, fruit and cactus leaves because they've been unable to plant or harvest sweet potatoes, tomatoes and other crops. Alice Ramoun, WFP Communications Officer in the capital, and Tananarivo, was in the region recently. She said families have been selling prized assets such as cattle, farmland and even homes to survive. Ms. Ramoun spoke to Deanne Penn about the UN agency's support to some 700,000 people, with plans to reach more and hopes for the COP26 climate change conference, which opens later this month in Glasgow, Scotland.
It's been several years now that Madagascar, and especially the south of Madagascar, is hit by a very severe drought that leave people and without any way to feed themselves. Because with the drought, and especially with no rain, they are not able to harvest anything because they can't plant, they can't sow, they can't harvest anything. So they don't have anything to eat right now. And we can say that there is more than 1 million people in southern Madagascar we are suffering from hunger right now.
Thank you so much, Alice. And tell us about that region.
What's it like? Because, of course, a lot of people, myself included, have never been to southern Madagascar.
It's a very rural area with small villages, and many people are living from their fields and from their field production. So if there is nothing growing anymore, they don't have anything to feed themselves and to sell at the market. So now in some area, you can find villages surrounded by fields, but fields are totally dried. Nothing can harvest. And sometimes when some of them have a little hope, they sow some seeds and try to irrigate more or less. And so something is growing, but it's just a few weeks after, because there is no rain, it's just drying. So it's quite impressive to see, you know, like tomato plants or so on, completely yellow or even brown because they are just dying because of the lack of water.
And now WFP are saying that this could be the world's first climate change induced famine. Can you explain why and how?
First of all, Madagascar, as many countries, has various seasons. There is a dry season, rainy season, and so on. But now the climate is really changing, and farmers who are really dependent from the climate, from the season, didn't really understand what it's happening, because there is, for example, more and more rain, stronger rain that cover fields from suns and so on. There is, of course, less rain. So when there is the first rain, they can maybe have hope and sow some seeds. But one little rain is not a proper rainy season. So if the first little rain is not followed by a second rain and several weeks of rain, it's not enough to have a proper harvest, and everything is dying because of the lack of rain. What we can say is that the impacts of climate change are really stronger and stronger. People can't grow anymore, so harvest fails constantly, and so people don't have anything to harvest and to renew their food stocks.
Thanks, Alice. Now, you say that even though people are even trying to plant crops, it's very, very hard. So what are they eating now, or what are they able to plant if they are able to plant anything?
So in some areas, they are still able to plant something, but it's not easy at all. So they are trying to grow like sweet potatoes. You can barely find sweet potatoes in some area in the south. But in some other area, absolutely nothing is growing right now. So people are just surviving, eating locusts, eating fruits and cactus leaves. And just as an example, cactus leaf is usually for cattle. It's not for human consumption. So it's really worrying. And I think one of the most impressive things I've seen, it's even cactus. You can find it everywhere in the south, and people are eating cactus fruits. Even cactus are dying from the drought. So it's really, really worrying.
Alice, you've been to the region. So can you tell us, did you speak to any people there, and what did they say, or what did you see for yourself?
I was in the south during 2 weeks, a few days ago, and it was really impressive because I went to various places, and in some areas, it's been a proper rainy season for 3 years. But maybe 100 kilometers away, they haven't seen a proper rainy season for 10 years. So it's really dependent on the area. And the difference between different area is really astonishing.
You've already mentioned the impacts the drought is having on farming, but are there any other impacts, say, for example, like on education or health? And I guess, obviously, malnutrition must be an issue. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so people have already started to develop coping mechanisms to survive. They are selling cattle, for example, to get money, to be able to buy food. But when Before, they were able to get food and feed themselves from their own field production. So it's really changing the daily life for people. They are also selling even more important assets, such as fields or even houses. And sometimes, yeah, they are taking off children from school. Also, strategy right now to gather the family's resources on finding, you know, income-generating activities involving children. So this has obviously a direct impact on education.
Can you tell us about WFP's response or WFP and partners, and what you're doing and also what support is needed?
The policy is providing two types of response in collaboration with other humanitarian partners and, of course, with the government. The first one is a life-saving food emergency response. So we are bringing food to 700,000 people, including prevention of malnutrition products. The second one is more a long-term response, to allow communities to be able to prepare for, respond to, and recover from climate shocks better. So this includes resilience projects, such as water projects, like irrigation canals, reforestation, and even microinsurance to help smallholder farmers to recover from a lost harvest, for example.
You said, of course, that your work is for both the short and the long term. Is WFP needing more support for Southern Madagascar, as a lot of people may not know about the current situation in the country?
Yes, it's a lot, and there's a lot of work to do. And so I've said that WFP is providing food assistance to 700,000 people, but we aim to support up to 1 million people from now to April. And this assistance to 1 million people will reduce the risk of more people falling up in famine-like condition. And that's why we need, in WFP in Madagascar, we need $69 million to do so and to work in this way. But we are also involving more partners to find and fund a climate change solution for the community to adapt impacts of climate change.
Now, we're just days away from the COP26 climate change conference. And what does WFP hope that the conference will achieve, particularly for the people of Southern Madagascar?
So for COP26, WFP wants to draw attention to a shift from crisis response to risk management, because we need to prepare for climate shocks and take early action at the global scale to reduce severe impacts on the most vulnerable people, such as people in Madagascar, for example. COP26 is also an opportunity for us to ask governments and donors to prioritize funding relating to climate adaptation programs to help countries to build a better risk management system, and even in Madagascar. Because if nothing is done, hunger will increase exponentially in the coming years because of climate change, and not only in Madagascar, but in other countries.
Well, it's amazing that we are in a place that has so many people gathered after the pandemic to show really what it means to be unified in a cause that brings us together. It's what the UN stands for, the Charter, people. Today we talk so much more about our home, the planet. And to be at Expo, to see nations united around concepts that are about the future, that are about people, equality, and really just the solidarity of our humanity. And it's important for us as we try to push our agendas for the Sustainable Development Goals, the framing of what should include everyone, leaving, as we say, no one behind. But it's a special day. It always is every year, but it has a little bit more meaning for us today that we have been so apart from one another. And this is a true expression of the world coming together.
So interesting to hear you, because you personally spearheaded the SDGs. I mean, looking back over those 10 years, what a journey.
It's an amazing journey, and everybody talks to the 17 goals as which is your favorite, but there is no one favorite. There are important ones that you need to plug and play, and gender equality is so important to us. But when you think about what they all mean in their totality, is a more peaceful and prosperous world, is more joined up, more respectful of our diversity, seeing the strengths of being together than being apart. And so UN Day, it just amplifies it.
I was telling you about my friend Fatima here in the UAE. She's a disability activist. And she said, don't treat me like a superhero and don't treat me like a victim. I'm just a person and please listen to me. And I know you've spent your whole life trying to give voice to people like that. And, you know, speaking of diversity, it really is a matter of like finding ourselves and expressing ourselves together. And what would you say about women like Fatima?
Well, women like Fatima are an inspiration to us. They are the reason why we do what we do with the Sustainable Development Goals. We say leave no one behind, and she's absolutely right. She's another human being in our family and deserves to be treated that way. So when we talk about diversity, it's the differences that we have, and how do we demonstrate that they are an equal and included part of that family? We still have a way to go. I met just over 2 days ago with other people living with disabilities, Vladimir Chuk, who heads up this whole Disability Alliance, but in our own office, Gopal, who has been the first on the 38th floor of the United Nations to really say that, look, see me, I am here shaping policy, and being inclusive means including me in not what you say as a member of the family, but as a really someone who is there to help us to design and co-create a world that includes everyone. So Fatima is an inspiration. She speaks truth to power. She's not embarrassed to talk about her reality. And I think that what she does is take away that sort of your eyes look down as you see a person with disabilities, or you begin to treat them differently, but to say that, look, you know, as I am, treat me as an equal.
That is exactly what she talked about. And your point about really integrating people on the 38th floor in your own office is so well taken. I'm always encouraged when I speak to you. I feel like you carry a light with you, so I'm going to ask you for some encouraging vision for the future.
Well, for me, the future is incredibly bright. There's never been a time in the world where we've had so much at our disposal, technology, connectivity, a spirit of can-do. And yet, we are not quite grasping the leadership that's needed to move forward and implement that and to get real with the intergenerational transition from us to younger people. So if I had any words of, as they say, wisdom, because we can say that at our age, right? It is one that just reinforces this journey that we have to take. If we talk about the Sustainable Development Goals, 9 years to go, what are your footprints going to look like? Greener, more peaceful, more effective, more proactive, standing for dignity and solidarity and rights at the center of it. All the things that really, if we embrace, will be a better world. And being at Expo this year is a reignition of that flame of hope. And that's what I want us to hold on to, the hopefulness of the future of mankind and its home, the planet.
So harboring is, generally speaking, one of the five acts that is mentioned in the international legal definition of trafficking in persons, together with, for example, transfer and recruitment. But harboring, and this came out of the study, is one of the most often cited acts to prosecute traffickers. So this is why we decided to do this study on really looking into what harboring actually means and what harboring actually means in different languages and in different countries, and to see whether or not this causes any obstacles, for example, in prosecution and investigating.
Could you just explain to me where this harboring takes place within the trafficking process? Because people are recruited and then they're exploited and sometimes they're moved to different locations. So where does harboring actually take place?
Harboring may take place at any time of the human trafficking process. The study specifically identified three different scenarios. So harboring that takes place even prior to exploitation. So the international legal definition does actually not require exploitation to have taken place. So it is possible that you, for example, keep a person with the intent of, for example, transporting them into another country where they are forced to work or forced into sexual exploitation. So it is enough that you keep them with the intent of exploiting them later on. So this is a form of harboring that happens prior to exploitation. A second scenario is when the one that is usually identified as human trafficking is when they are harbored at the same time as they are being exploited. This may happen, for example, in a hotel room where a person is being sexually exploited. So it's possible to harbor them in the in this hotel room or in any room in a brothel. So it's possible to harbor them at the same time as exploiting the victim. But there's also a third scenario, and this is where harboring takes place not at the place where also exploitation takes place, but completely separate from the exploitation. I can give you an example. For example, if you force a child into going begging, so into forced begging on the street, the child is moving around all day in the city, but the child is then coming home in a place where they are kept over the night. So this is a scenario where harboring takes place alongside the exploitation, but not at the same time as exploitation. And interestingly, this is also, if we would prosecute this, this is also the place where harboring would be raised as the only act that is applicable in human trafficking. So this is why it's very important to be clear on what harboring actually means within the international legal definition.
If a case of trafficking does actually lead to a prosecution, what is the impact of proof that harboring existed to actually secure a conviction?
Usually experts kept telling us that for them harboring is a relatively straightforward manner, so that they rarely run into issues of having to prove harboring. But once we started to explain them and started to talk about what harboring means to them, it's only then that we realized that harboring is not as a straightforward concept that everybody thought it was. It is. For example, one of the issues that was raised that harboring especially is understood differently in different languages. So it's possible that, for example, that you have to prove that the person has been concealed or that a person's liberty has been restricted in order to constitute harboring. This is the case in some countries, but in not all of the countries. So the evidence that you need to show that a person has been harbored might be different in one country than in another, which also means that the trafficking might have happened in one country but not in another. And this has a severe impact on the alleged perpetrator, on the victim of trafficking, but also on the state and the state authorities, that they have available certain, for example, investigative methods that they would not usually have, for example, regarding a robbery. They do have them available if they are qualified in the right way. So it's these discrepancies that we try to show in our study on the issue paper of the concept of harboring.
For harboring to be seen as an act of trafficking, does the victim have to be physically restricted somehow? Do they have to be a minder? They're not allowed to leave the premises?
This may be a requirement in some of the countries, but not in all of the countries. This goes back to how harboring is understood, most notably in the different languages. For example, in English and in Russian, there is a certain negative connotation of what harboring means. It usually involves the concealment of or the hiding of the victim from authorities. But this is, for example, not the case in the French and in the Arabic version of the word harboring, that is more used in the sense of hosting a friend or hosting a guest. So it's possible that, for example, that you do not have to show that the person has been hiding or controlling, physically controlling the person in order to harbor them, depending on where you are. So depending on in what language do you speak. So it is not necessarily a requirement for harboring to take place to limit the victim's liberty of movement.
If there is a different interpretation in a different language of the term harboring, what does this mean? What are the implications then for prosecutions, convictions?
The impact, or if harboring is understood differently, or if harboring is not understood in a comprehensive way, it might have an impact on three people. First of all, the alleged perpetrator. So for the perpetrator, knowing or not knowing if there is a charge on human trafficking has also, for example, an impact on the sentence, on the possible sentence that is given to the perpetrator. So being clear about the concept of harboring also means being clear whether or not human trafficking has happened. And this means in return that the perpetrator might face more severe or less severe sentencing depending on the qualification of what the behavior has been qualified as. A second person who is impacted by this concept or by the clarity of this concept is the victim. So the victim or the survivor of human trafficking often depends on being identified as a victim of human trafficking. There are in the law certain privileges and certain rights that a victim of human trafficking has, which all depend on the qualification or the identification of the victim of having been a victim of human trafficking. So for the victim, it is absolutely mandatory and absolutely important to know whether human trafficking has taken place or has not taken place. And thirdly, it's important for the investigator or the other state authorities to know whether human trafficking has taken place, because it allows them to use specific investigation tools that are only available, for example, in transnational organized crime or in case human trafficking has been committed, but also, for example, international collaboration. So there are certain mechanisms that are in place that depend on the qualification of human trafficking in order for investigators to be able to use them. So, and this one is very important, for example, also to be speaking the same language or to speaking the same legal language as, the, for example, another country is, that you have to be able to trust that when you talk about human trafficking, that this is the same or this is understood similarly in another country. And this is also where the study comes in, because we try to highlight elements or highlight situations in which this notion of harboring and this notion of human trafficking might be understood differently in one country to another, which impedes collaboration between the states and which in turn impedes prosecutions of the perpetrators.
What do we actually know about these places of harboring? Because the exploitation itself must be totally horrific. But where are these victims actually having to sleep or eat or, you know, take care of their personal hygiene? What is known about the places?
Victims might be harbored in different locations. This might happen in a hotel room. It might happen in a room in a brothel, but it might also happen on a shipping vessel or on in a factory. It all depends on of what kind of form or what kind of exploitation we are talking about. So exploitation might be of sexual nature. So harboring might be taking place, as I mentioned, in a hotel room or in a brothel. But there are other forms of exploitation, for example, forced labor, where victims are harbored in a factory or in a house separate from the factory. But there's also other forms of exploitation, for example, human trafficking for the purpose of organ removal. So there, harboring may take place in a hospital room as well. And then we have certain elements or certain forms of human trafficking where harboring is less easy to identify. For example, harboring of sexual exploitation online. So there it becomes very difficult to know where exactly the place of harboring is and who controls this place of harboring. Or situations where the victims are harbored while on the move. So when is it possible or is it not possible that a lorry or a truck can be considered a place of harboring as well? So this is always depends on what the specific situation of the exploitation is and what kind or what kind of form of human trafficking we are talking about.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In South Sudan, UN-appointed independent rights experts have issued a warning over state-led restrictions and credible death threats made against the country's most prominent civil society leaders. In the alert, the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan said that overzealous security forces have prevented dissent so dramatically that civic space was now eroding at an accelerating pace, undermining efforts to achieve a sustainable peace. The actions of the National Security Services have included detentions, raids, a likely internet shutdown, and an enhanced presence on the streets of Juba, the panel said in a statement. Those targeted by threats, harassment, and intimidation have included prominent human rights defenders, journalists, and civil society actors. Many have played a key role in the country's ongoing peace and justice processes. Jane David Collock and Michael Wanny are among those now sheltering outside the country in fear for their lives, the UN Commission said in reference to Mr. Collock, a member of the Truth, Reconciliation and Healing Panel, and Mr. Wanny, who was involved in constitutional reform. Humanitarian assistance has been reinforced on Yemen's west coast, where ongoing violence has increased the needs of communities displaced by years of conflict, the International Organization for Migration said on Wednesday. Its response has been focused on the governorates of Taiz and Hodeidah, where active front lines have continued to force families to flee. Mass displacement in the area began in 2017, and some 17,000 displaced families now live in more than 140 displacement sites while fighting continues. Most recently, clashes in eastern Al-Tahaita district have displaced more than 200 families, IOM said. Its life-saving interventions in 13 displacement sites include providing shelter, clean water, latrines, cash, and essential relief items to thousands of families in need. The organization is also expanding the availability of healthcare to affected populations, as well as increasing COVID-19 testing. A warning now about how an increase in the use of new technologies has the potential to force people to reveal or alter their thoughts. A UN-appointed independent human rights expert has called for clarification on the scope and content of the right to freedom of thought. Major developments in digital technology, neuroscience and cognitive psychology may have unprecedented consequences for the privacy and integrity of our thoughts, said Ahmed Shahid, Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief. In his report to the UN General Assembly on Tuesday, Mr. Shahid maintained that counter-terrorism measures, re-education programs, torture, forcible administration of psychoactive drugs, and other coercive mental health practices may be used without permission to alter people's thoughts or to force them to reveal their thoughts. The report makes recommendations on how to respect, protect, and promote freedom of thought. The Special Rapporteur emphasized that this largely unexplored right must not be restricted even during public emergencies. Freedom of thought is not only imperative in one's freedom to choose, develop or change convictions, but also fundamental in thinking on all matters independently of religion or belief systems, he said. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hello, in this week's show, the Jimi Hendrix of the Sahel, Vieux Facuture, sings us a message of peace as an antidote to climate change, violent extremism and mass displacement. We also hear the latest stories from the UN News team covering Afghanistan, COVID-19 and a radical weather forecasting initiative from the World Meteorological Organization. With closing comments too from regular guest Solange Behadege-Cortez. That's all coming up, but first the news with Katie Dartford.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Afghanistan's economy is imploding, with all but 3% of households expected to fall below the poverty line in coming months, the UN said on Thursday. To help ordinary Afghans, the UN Development Programme has announced the launch of a People's Economy Fund to provide desperately needed access to cash. The fund will tap into donations frozen since the Taliban takeover in August. Germany has already pledged $58 million of the more than $660 million required over the next 12 months, said Achim Steiner, UNDP Administrator.
There are 38 million people who cannot be kept alive just from the outside. We have to step in, we have to stabilize a people's economy, and in addition to saving lives in the immediate, we also have to save livelihoods, because otherwise we will confront indeed a scenario through this winter and into next year where millions and millions of Afghans are simply unable to stay on their land, in their homes, in their villages and survive.
New data analysed by the WHO has revealed that between 80,000 and 180,000 healthcare workers could have died from COVID-19 between January last year and May 2021. These estimates were calculated from the 3.45 million coronavirus-related deaths reported globally to the UN Health Agency as of May this year, a figure that WHO said may well be at least 60% lower than the actual number of victims. The development comes as the UN Health Agency warned that the pandemic will go on a year longer than it needs to because poorer countries have not received the vaccines they should have. Barely 1 in 20 people in Africa have been vaccinated, compared with around 4 in 10 globally. The UN has announced sweeping initiatives to strengthen the gathering of data which is needed for accurate weather and climate forecasting to protect vulnerable communities around the globe. The World Meteorological Organization said that all 193 member states had approved the sharing of vital observations in the face of climate change and increasing extreme weather events. WMO's Secretary General Petteri Tallas said that the growing vulnerability of people living in high-risk areas and concerns about issues such as food security are contributing to a huge increase in demand for information about weather, climate and water and their impacts. Katie Dartford, UN News.
The headlines there, and you're listening to UN Catch Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. And now to this week's interview, which takes us to Africa, and more specifically Bamako in Mali. It's home to musician Vieux Faka Touré, son of acclaimed Malian musician Ali Faka Touré, and he's composed a great new song, A Song for the Sahel, to raise awareness about the problems so many people in the region are encountering because of climate change, lack of government, and violent extremism. Here he is now taking time out from a recording session in his studio.
Happy Allah Kaulana
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Wow, private performance. Don't get that every day at the studio. So thank you so much, Vieux Faka Touré. Speaking to the United Nations from Bamako in Mali, and we are, unfortunately, I should say, really going to have to talk about darker subjects than the wonderful music you've just been playing. We're talking about the Sahel crisis, one of the world's fastest growing emergencies. And to raise awareness about this, you have composed, produced, and co-opted your fellow musicians into a wonderful music initiative, which is called The Song for the Sahel. Can you tell me about it and why you're doing this?
Yes. You know, I think, and thank you for inviting me to speak at the United Nations. For me, it's very important and very special, to do something for the Sahel. I mean, I am one of the song from the Sahel. It's when I'm born, it's when I'm grow up, so it's my home.
So when we hear about the Sahel and the displacement and the life-saving assistance that's needed there, it seems to be getting worse and worse. We hear that this year alone almost 30 million people need that urgent critical assistance and protection, which is 5 million more than last year. So what is it that your song and your music is going to bring to the table that international negotiations and military might cannot?
For me, first, the music have big power, very big power, to touch every person living there, the good people, the bad people. It's what you said, you know. The people decide what we're going to do. It's for everybody, these songs. Because, you know, it's not just the guys having gun. The guys having gun have some, they decide. So, do this or not? So, this song is just to tell them, if they accept, because this, to tell them how we have to live together.
That's the message. We have to live together.
That's the message, yeah. So this is why when they ask me to doing this song, I just jump, say, okay, yes, because I need to give my own message in these people. And it's very important for me to doing this, you know.
Because you're known as the Hendrix of the Sahel, is that right? What do you think about that mantle? That's quite a lot of pressure, huh?
Yeah. But you have to know, sometimes to doing, having inspiration, to having something to do correctly, I need to play this music first. It's going to, Sahara music going to give me when and what I have to say. You know, it's how it's coming. So when I'm starting to doing, I'm doing the music first. And every morning when I come to the studio, I'm just listening to this music. And I ask myself, what am I going to tell them? What am I going to do with this music? What they want to know? What they want to listen?
But I mean, is the situation such that it just weighs on your mind every day? Describe the day-to-day for people in Mali.
You know, here it's like every day everybody just jumping in the Facebook and all stuff to see and to ask what's happened now. We are always like here we say we sleep with one eye. It's one eye just to hear, you know.
With one eye open.
Yes, and one eye open. Because we never know what's going to happen. We never know.
That's no way to live, huh?
You know, before I just take my car from Bamako to Nyafanke and sleep in the like in the village somewhere. Now, when you take the car from Bamako to go to Nyafanke, it's you have to ask every 1 kilometer. Okay, here to the 1 kilometer there. What's happened there? It's good. It's no problem. Okay, let's go. It's how we go now. Every minute we can have problem. So we can't go anymore. Like even it's Bamako Segou.
Even in Bamako, it's dangerous.
Everywhere is dangerous here now. I'm sure okay. Every time. It's because the people don't have nothing to eat, and it's starting. You know, they don't have nothing. It's very like something else. You know, this is Bamako Mopti Segou. What about North Mali? Tombouctou, Gao? I don't know what the people are doing there. I go there sometime to see what's happened. Why the Foundation Ali Farka Touré will try to help the people there, but I think you have to be there to see exactly what's happened.
Well, we have your song to tell us about it. We have the musicians who collaborated with you to make it. One of the demographics, one of your target audiences is the young, your younger listeners who make up a large part of the demographic in the Sahel, and they are going to be the region's future. So what's your particular message to youngsters in the Sahel?
So what I tell the young in the North Mali today, the young guys, they don't have nothing to do, no work. So this why some young people, you know, go to the jihadism, the extremism. You know, it's like example, somebody living there somewhere, he don't have like $1 per day. And somebody's come to him to say, okay, come on, I want to give you 5,000 per day and I give you a gun. He go. He don't like to stay anymore. He say, okay, if you give me 5,000, I'm going to follow you. Let's go. Maybe you take the gun 2 days, 3 days after, you die. So we have to be live in peace. I'm sure I speak with some guys, tell me, okay, if I have work today, I'm not going to take gun.
I wonder, in your young life, have you seen the impacts of climate change in the country? Because it's linked, of course, to conflict.
You know, I think the Sahel is the where everything's doing there, you know. Maybe some people like living in the United States, you know, staying in England or staying in France, they think, okay, the Sahel is nothing, it's Sahel, it's Africa. But everything's bad here, it's coming there.
And final question to you, if I may, Mr. Touré. We've been talking about some very serious stuff, but maybe it would be nice to remind everyone how much fun I hope it was making this song for the Sahel. You're smiling now.
For me, you can imagine how it's an honor. You know, it's a very, very important to me to doing this song. I want to just say thank to United Nations. Thank all the guys working on these songs. It's not just Vieux Farka Touré. So I want to just say I'm very happy. If I have to do this again, don't worry. I'm going to do it anytime you guys want to do.
Vieux Farka Touré, thank you for speaking to the United Nations today.
Yeah, I'm very happy. It's good.
My thanks to Vieux Farka Touré. For the full interview, go to unnews.com/audiohub. Now, with Vieux's wonderful voice and laugh still brightening up my day, let me turn to Solange Berdega-Cortez for some closing comments to see what inspiration she's had from this fantastic Sahel project from the UN Humanitarian Coordination Office, OCHA. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. The Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, whom we have quoted several times here on UN Catch Up, in particular his poem about the refugees, the nobodies, once described himself as a witness with open eyes and an attentive ear. Vieux Farka Touré living in Sahel is more than a witness, but like Galeano, He told you, Daniel, that people in the Sahel sleep with one eye open. They may see phantoms of the terror, but they also have their ears alert to the music. Vieux-Far Katouré strongly believes that his music can be a powerful instrument for change, leaving indelible traces in the sand of the Sahel and in people's minds. If you think about it, the effects of Vieux's music are extraordinary. It has its roots in the blues, so he blends with this traditional music. Once combined, he delivers a message of change and hope in a climate of war, insecurity, hunger, and crisis. Where a child that has only known war might just as well pick up a Kalashnikov, Vieux shows that a guitar may be an equally powerful tool for inspiring change, other paths than violence. The 5-minute song for the Sahel, which Vieux produced, addresses youth in particular. It says, "We must work together so we can take care of this land, and we must know that nothing is worth more than peace. Nothing remains but to make peace between us." These are not the words of a terrorist. Rather, they show a conviction that the Sahel is not an empty place, but an inspiring region, a living place where people are born, grow old, and love. We learned that Vieux-Far Katouré is known as the Hendrix of the Sahel. Well, he said famously that if there is something to be changed in this world, then it can only happen through music. Let's hope that others will be inspired to try this approach too. To paraphrase the English poet and author Edward Bulwer Lytton with the greatest of respect, the guitar may indeed be mightier than the sword.
The guitar may indeed be mightier than the sword. Nice one. Thank you very much, Solange. And for my part, music, art, theatre, whatever tool works with getting the message across of peace is fine with me. It's better than a gun. Now, we're supposed to be wrapping up, I'm afraid, so let me say a huge thank you to you for being here again this week, for your closing comments. Thank you, listeners, for being part of the show too, and for following the UN's work. If you would like more headlines, stories, and interviews, just check out UN News. We'll be back next week, and this time looking at a World Food Day initiative from the Food and Agriculture Organization. Until then, stay well. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. More than 1 million people in southern Madagascar are going hungry in what the World Food Programme, WFP, believes could become the first ever famine brought on by climate change. Successive years of drought have forced people in rural communities to eat locusts, fruit and cactus leaves because they've been unable to plant or harvest sweet potatoes, tomatoes and other crops. Alice Ramoun, WFP Communications Officer in the capital, and Tananarivo, was in the region recently. She said families have been selling prized assets such as cattle, farmland and even homes to survive. Ms. Ramoun spoke to Deanne Penn about the UN agency's support to some 700,000 people, with plans to reach more and hopes for the COP26 climate change conference, which opens later this month in Glasgow, Scotland.
It's been several years now that Madagascar, and especially the south of Madagascar, is hit by a very severe drought that leave people and without any way to feed themselves. Because with the drought, and especially with no rain, they are not able to harvest anything because they can't plant, they can't sow, they can't harvest anything. So they don't have anything to eat right now. And we can say that there is more than 1 million people in southern Madagascar who are suffering from hunger right now.
Thank you so much, Alice. And tell us about that region. What's it like? Because, of course, a lot of people, myself included, have never been to southern Madagascar.
It's a very rural area with small villages, and many people are living from their fields and from their field production. So if there is nothing growing anymore, they don't have anything to feed themselves. and to sell at the market. So now in some area, you can find villages surrounded by fields, but fields are totally dried. Nothing can harvest, and sometimes when some of them have a little hope, they sow some seeds and try to irrigate more or less. And so something is growing, but it's just a few weeks after, because there is no rain, it's just drying. So it's quite impressive to see, you know, like tomato plants or so on, completely yellow or even brown because they are just dying because of the lack of water.
And now WFP are saying that this could be the world's first climate change induced famine. Can you explain why and how?
First of all, Madagascar, as many countries, has various seasons. There is usually there is a dry season, rainy season, and so on. But now the climate is really changing, and farmers who are really dependent from the climate, from the season, didn't really understand what it's happening, because there is, for example, more and more wind, stronger wind that cover fields from suns and so on. There is, of course, less rain. So when there is the first rain, they can maybe have hope and sow some seeds. But one little rain is not a proper rainy season. So if the first little rain is not followed by a second rain and several weeks of rain, it's not enough to have a proper harvest, and everything is dying because of the lack of rain. What we can say is that the impacts of climate change are really stronger and stronger. People can't grow anymore, so harvest fails constantly, and so people don't have anything to harvest and to renew their food stocks.
Thanks, Alice. Now, you say that even though people are even trying to plant crops, it's very, very hard. So what are they eating now, or what are they able to plant if they are able to plant anything?
So in some areas, they are still able to plant something, but it's not easy at all. So they are trying to grow like sweet potatoes. You can barely find sweet potatoes in some area in the south. But in some other area, absolutely nothing is growing right now. So people are just surviving, eating locusts, eating fruits and cactus leaves. And just as an example, a cactus leaf is usually for cattle. It's not for human consumption. So it's really worrying. And I think one of the most impressive things I've seen, it's even cactus. You can find it everywhere in the south, and people are eating cactus fruits. Even cactus are dying from the drought. So it's really, really worrying.
Alice, you've been to the region, so can you tell us, did you speak to any people there, and what did they say, or what did you see for yourself?
I was in the south during 2 weeks, a few days ago, and it was really impressive because I went to various places, and in some areas, in a proper rainy season for 3 years, but maybe 100 kilometers away, they haven't seen a proper rainy season for 10 years. So it's really dependent on the area, and the difference between different area is really astonishing.
You've already mentioned the impacts the drought is having on farming, but are there any other impacts, say, for example, like on education or health? And I guess obviously malnutrition must be an issue. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so people have already started to develop coping mechanisms to survive. They are selling cattle, for example, to get money, to be able to buy food. But when before they were able to get food and feed themselves from their own field production. So it's really changing the daily life for people. They are also selling even more important assets, such as fields or even houses. And sometimes, yes, they are taking off children from school. Also, strategy right now to gather the family's resources on finding, you know, income generating activities involving children. So this has obviously a direct impact on education.
Can you tell us about WFP's response or WFP and partners and what you're doing and also what support is needed?
The policy is providing two types of response in collaboration with other humanitarian partners and, of course, with the government. The first one is a life-saving food emergency response. So we are bringing food to 700,000 people, including prevention of malnutrition products. The second one is more a long-term response to allow communities to be able to prepare for, respond to, and recover from climate shocks better. So this includes resilience projects such as water projects like irrigation canals, reforestation, and even microinsurance to help smallholder farmers to recover from a lost harvest, for example.
You said, of course, that your work is for the, both the short and the long term. Is WFP needing more support for Southern Madagascar, as a lot of people may not know about the current situation in the country?
Yes, it's a lot, and there's a lot of work to do. And so I said that WFP is providing food assistance to 700,000 people, but we aim to support up to 1 million people from now to April. And this assistance to 1 million people will reduce the risk of more people falling up in famine-like condition. And that's why we need, in WFP in Madagascar, we need $69 million to do so and to work in this way. But we are also involving more partners to find and fund a climate change solution for the community to adapt impacts of climate change.
Now, we're just days away from the COP26 climate change conference. And what does WFP hope that the conference will achieve, particularly for the people of Southern Madagascar?
So for COP26, WFP wants to draw attention to a shift from crisis response to risk management, because we need to prepare for climate shocks and take early action at the global scale to reduce severe impacts on the most vulnerable people, such as people in Madagascar, for example. COP26 is also an opportunity for us to ask governments and donors to prioritize funding relating to climate adaptation programs to help countries to build a better risk management system, and even in Madagascar. Because if nothing is done, hunger will increase exponentially in the coming years because of climate change, and not only in Madagascar, but in other countries.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Afghanistan's economy is imploding, with all but 3% of households expected to fall below the poverty line in coming months, the UN said on Thursday. To help ordinary Afghans, the UN Development Programme has announced the launch of a People's Economy Fund to provide desperately needed access to cash. The fund will tap into donations frozen since the Taliban takeover in August. Germany has already pledged $58 million of the more than $660 million required over the next 12 months, said Achim Steiner, UNDP administrator.
There are 38 million people who cannot be kept alive just from the outside. We have to step in, we have to stabilize a people's economy, and in addition to saving lives in the immediate, we also have to save livelihoods, because otherwise we will confront indeed a scenario through this winter and into next year where millions and millions of Afghans are simply unable to stay on their land, in their homes, in their villages and survive.
New data analysed by the WHO has revealed that between 80,000 and 180,000 healthcare workers could have died from COVID-19 between January last year and May 2021. These estimates were calculated from the 3.45 million coronavirus-related deaths reported globally to the UN Health Agency as of May this year, a figure that WHO said may well be at least 60% lower than the actual number of victims. The development comes as the UN Health Agency warned that the pandemic will go on a year longer than it needs to because poorer countries have not received the vaccines they should have. Barely 1 in 20 people in Africa have been vaccinated, compared with around 4 in 10 globally. in a call for concrete action to better protect health and care workers worldwide from COVID-19 and other infections. WHO and partner organizations expressed concern at the large number of health and care workers who have died from the virus, but also that an increasing proportion is suffering from burnout, stress, anxiety, and fatigue. The UN has announced sweeping initiatives to strengthen the gathering of data which is needed for accurate weather and climate forecasting to protect vulnerable communities around the globe. Announcing the news on Thursday, the World Meteorological Organization said that all 193 member states had approved the sharing of vital observations in the face of climate change and increasing extreme weather events. The agency has unveiled three new protocols to boost information sharing, which will help to fill data gaps in some regions, and at the same time try to meet huge demand for weather and climate data products and services. Welcoming the development, WMO's Secretary General Petteri Tallas said that the growing vulnerability of people living in high-risk areas and concerns about issues such as food security are contributing to a huge increase in demand for information about weather, climate and water and their impacts. Katie Dartford, UN News.